session 252 of the 2010 Sunstone Symposium. This session is headed In Memoriam, Linda Sillitoe. There are four presenters for this session. John Sillitoe and his husband. John was born in Salt Lake City and received degrees in history and political science from the University of Utah. He's been an archivist, a curator of special collections, and a professor of libraries at Weber State University. But when I first met him and Linda, he was an archivist working for the LDS Church, as I was. Paul Swenson, over here, says his earliest memory of Linda Sillitoe was her suggesting we put his children in open classroom school when they were still small, but they could be influenced for the good. That was Linda. She was an activist in just about everything she did. Phyllis Barber, right here, is absent, but that's all right.
She'll be right back.
She first knew Linda when they were both writers for Utah Holiday in the late 1970s, which is when I first met them. And they kept up on each other's writing projects thereafter. Alan Roberts, the remaining formal presenter, was the co-writer with Linda of Salamander, the Story of the Mormon Forgery Murders, published by Signature Books. And at that time, you were still with Sunstone about that time, Alan?
No.
Okay, Alan had left Sunstone at that time. The apostates always come back. We can't get rid of them. The informal members of this session are you out there. At the end of the session, rather than question and answer, if you feel so inclined, you can't ask a question and expect an answer, but if you feel so inclined, step to that microphone, put your lips about this close to it, because these microphones are not designed for broad spectrum pickup, and tell us your memory of Linda. To aid that, I ask you to take out your cell phone. I don't have one, but this will do. And switch it off, and turn it off, and beat it on the pulpit, and kick it once or twice, so that in the middle of the session, we don't have someone getting up with the cell phone going, and they walk all the way down the back and out the door. That way, those who can't attend this session will still be able to get the spirit and flavor of the session. And for a session like this, I think that's going to be critical. I assume, John, that you will start.
Yeah.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I give you John Sillitoe. I have to, because he generally keeps to himself unless someone gives him.
Oh, if we could just get Dennis to come out of his shell. First, I'd like to thank Sunstone for making it possible to celebrate Linda's life and the impact on the Mormon intellectual community that she had. I appreciate it very much. Second, I'm really pleased that Alan, Paul, and Phyllis are here to speak, and that all of you will have a chance to make some comments as well. Third, as someone who tears up when the latest celebrity enters rehab, okay, this could be interesting, but we'll see. For all of these reasons, I'll try to be brief and allow as much time as possible for everyone else. I first met Linda 50 years ago, next month. It was in Mr. Jensen's homeroom class in Lincoln Junior High here in Salt Lake City. I think it's fair to say it wasn't love at first sight on either of our parts. I thought she was kind of skinny. She thought I was the class clown. Looking back, I think those assessments were pretty accurate. We saw each other from time to time during our 3 years at Lincoln, had some classes together, but there was nothing especially memorable about that period. That would change with the progression from Lincoln Junior High to South High School in that warm fall of 1963. We appeared together in a sophomore class skit at the beginning of the semester, where she was a sleeping princess and I played her father, the king. The lines of the skit were not memorable then, and they're certainly forgotten now, But what I do remember is that I kept breaking her up with asides that she could hear, but were not loud enough for the audience to hear. So, of course, they thought she was crazy. I discovered she had a great laugh. Once again, circumstances did not bring us together much that 63-64 school year, though we shared the trauma of the JFK assassination with no foreshadowing of the similar events that we would witness in the future. I guess every generation thinks it lives in the most interesting of times. We often talked about how much history we had lived through. The next year, things would change some. By then, I had moved from being class clown to budding agnostic intellectual politico, and I noticed she was, well, not quite so skinny as she had been, but had in fact filled out, if you will. Mostly, I saw her through visiting her sister Susan, who was editor of the Sapphire Scribe, while I was a lonely reporter who often took Susan copies of the paste-ups before they went to the printer. Oh my, those were the dark ages with paste-ups. As I waited in the Bueller household while Susan examined what I had brought, I kind of kept noticing that younger sister. Things intensified during our senior year. By then, Susan had moved on to Stanford, and I had to find other ways to stay in contact with Linda. That came in the form of a twofold form of inquiring editor and debate class. The former was a kind of dorky TV program where students from local high schools were divided into male and female teams to compete in answering questions on topics of current events. The boys lost, creamed as I recall, but more importantly, we all piled into one car to return to school, and since there wasn't a great deal of room, Linda sat on my lap. "Hey, this current event stuff's not so bad after all," I said to myself. Debate was, well, it was debate. Intense, competitive, strategic. Linda, along with her debate partner, Mary Jo Pierce, was all of those things. But when the debate was over, the fun broke out. And she was that as well. To make a long story short, we dated through our senior year, entered the U of U, clearly intent on getting married, and we did in June 1968. Our early years had most of the challenges common to any young couple, as well as some unique ones. I was a bit chagrined our first semester that Linda pulled A's in poli-sci, while I didn't. Hey, I knew that stuff. But she was a better student, and she wrote better. Luckily, she helped me to improve in both of those areas. You know, it's interesting in a way that we even stayed in college. To be real honest, though both of our families expected, frankly, I was mostly there to avoid the draft. And Linda had a scholarship that not only paid for classes and books, but other things, including our china. Some of these funds came from winning an improvement era contest. That's what kept her in school. So ironically, the church kind of made it possible for Linda's future career. As I say, some of the challenges we faced were unique. To celebrate our first anniversary, we went on a little vacation. Linda suggested we play Scrabble. I had no idea how seriously, then and for the rest of our time together, she took Scrabble. On the first move, she used all seven letters. Some placed on double and triple and quadruple, whatever, word spaces, and gained, oh, I don't know, 100 points, 150 maybe. Spelling, toenail. The next move, she added an S to make it toenails. A couple of moves later, she spelled toenail across the board. So the Scrabble board said toenails. I knew it was all over. I don't think I ever beat her at Scrabble, except a couple of times when I cheated. As the years passed, I also realized how serious she was about writing and how important it was to her. At first, it was church stuff, road shows, readers' theater, occasional poems, and the children's friend. During those years, she gained a certain notoriety. Ah, the best was yet to come, believe me. And she got real encouragement from lots of people. I well remember, for example, Leonard Arrington calling with compliments on her latest poem in The Friend and telling her to keep it up. It meant a lot, and I think both of us learned a lesson about what is expected from the older generation to the younger. I came to see that writing was her vocation, not just an aside. It was central, fundamental, essential to who she was. You'll hear more about this from the others on the panel on writing and the impact she had. Suffice it to say that she came to believe she had a real role to play as a communicator between and among the various Mormon communities and with what we called in those days Mormon watchers. And think of the issues she took on as a journalist. IWY, Sonia Johnson, Mark Hoffman among them. And still there was time for fiction and personal essays and her beloved poetry. Once her bio at a Sunstone Symposium listed her as an investigating poet. She loved that bio. Well, I could go on and on about her writing, why we spelled our names differently, her kinship with Red Rock Country and Native peoples, how she became an investigative reporter by watching the Watergate hearings, how we survived Nixon and the war, and how we hoped we would never see another one. I could tell you how moved she was when Barack Obama was elected. I could tell you about her spirituality, her stubbornness, her compassion, her love affair with language. And I could tell you from personal experience what a tough editor she could be. But right now she would be saying, John, get on with it. Move along. So another time, perhaps. So let me end with a fortune I got in a Chinese restaurant recently. Hey, along with Seinfeld and Jimmy Buffett, that's pretty much the source of whatever insights I happen to have. Okay, I need to take a deep breath here. It read, "Faith is the bird that feels the light and sings while the dawn is still dark." Somewhere in that light, in the light of that still dark dawn, I know Linda is singing. Thank you.
Thank you so much, John. That was really beautiful. When I think of Linda Soto, I remember dark eyes, a quiet, measured presence, a sense that here was a woman who had a great deal of internal debate and wondering, jousting with each other at all times of the day. I remember always those dark eyes that said so much to me, though who knows about the idea of projection and how we see each other in each other's eyes. Linda and I both wrote for Utah Holiday, both fledgling writers at the time. In the days before our paths diverged and I went off to study fiction writing at the University of Utah and at Vermont College MFA in writing program, and Linda went off to write for the Deseret News to pursue her PhD at the University of Utah. Did she ever finish that? Oh, okay.
She became an investigative poet.
Okay, that's right. I thought that's what happened. And to write fine poetry, her book Sideways to the Sun, and to investigate with Alan Roberts the story of Mark Hoffman in Salamander, the story of the Mormon forgery murders, to write the history of the Utah chapter of the ACLU and the history of Salt Lake County, among many other things. We both had an exceptional editor in Paul Swenson, who had a great deal of faith in the writers who came to him with their "I want to be a writer" stars in their eyes, our unique, never heard before or so we thought ideas, our hopes for publishing some of our precious words, our pie-in-the-sky aspiration. Paul was instrumental in giving both Linda and myself confidence in our dreams, and I'm sure Linda would applaud him today for all the encouragement that he gave to us, and he's really a very important part of our writing careers. Linda and I often had stories appearing in the same issue of the magazine and brushed against each other in the doorways to Utah Holiday. We ate canapes at the Utah Holiday Christmas parties and exchanged a few bits of information about our current lives. I began to know something more about her husband John and about her daughters and the trials of marriage and separation about the things that captured her attention. But every time I think of Linda again, I see those dark eyes. I wish I would have taken more time to understand who she was, what she cared for more than anything, and what mattered to her on a daily basis. As I think of those eyes and what they said about her soul and her interior world, I wish I could recapture those moments when we were together. I wish I could recapture Linda. But in the way of writers, there are those words that we leave behind, those words that we've manipulated, crafted, stretched, examined, tossed, and turned with at night, those words we've tried so hard to lasso and make them say something that we deeply wished to say. There are those magazine articles, newspaper articles, those books, those poems, that collection of words that we've employed to hold the dam of the self, to collect together the chaos of being alive and to bring sense to it. The trying to understand what it's all about and why we are here doing what we are doing, and whether or not there is something beyond our mad scrambling for the right words at the right time and place. I was happy to be able to recapture some of Linda's sense and sensibility when I turned to her poems, to her words, to her craftsmanship, such as the lines from an opening to In Riverdale. We returned to our beginnings in August with its Crayola green trees and grass, blue sky, and yellow light so certainly imposed that desert light at night and hues wavered within us. And I don't know how many of you know all of her poetry, but I think it's very worth revisiting, so I wanted to share a few of these with you. One of my favorites is called Fact of My Life. My job was once threatened if I published a poem. I lived in another place but in America and knew my rights. I let the poem wait. Oh, I read it aloud once and silence swelled in the room like fog. Then someone said, "Read it again." My job was once threatened if I published a poem. A fact of my life I forgot. One of my children don't know. A journalist warned a truth, nothing but. I wrote it at City Desk and assigned to the story. My job was once threatened if I published a poem for a public figure. No libel there, nothing false or obscene, only love and anger, dignity and crumbs. The second time I read it, its silence rose and his relative, who questioned me later. After I left my job, I published the poem. Then left the place and forgot the threat. Remembering, I ponder the knots lodged under my shoulder blades, asking if one truly can leave a place where poems hold such power. It's good. Makes me want to read it. Last part to you again. And I found her incredible sensitivity again as I read this poem, Encounter, about her complex and beautiful relationship with her parents, and which reflects so well the complexity that most of us have with people we love. Encounter. Absently, I opened the medicine cabinet in my folks' house, searching for a comb. Then stood stunned as you wafted out like a genie. So generous with cologne and aftershave, I glanced behind me. The room wavered like my knees. Staring into that worn square of shelves, I wondered, has she kept everything? 2 years later, even your shaving brush bristles from its cup amid the scents of you spruced up, agenda laid, ready to go. Alone does she press this latch to summon you who left without giving notice. Will it ever become easier to let you out the door? And finally, here's a poem, one of her earliest poems that she wrote in 1974. And I think that this speaks to all of us and our familiarity with the ancestors we've loved and have in common. Still Life Study of an Ancestor. Warren Walling, seed of fishers of the sea who ward to birth a nation of vast vision, studied thrift, hard labor, common sense, belief in God and good, grasped the word, and with his outcast wife and six offspring plodded to Iowa in time to see the saints escape. settled, nevertheless, printed, thrived, sired 2 more children who lived past birth, and on a prudent day and cautiously looked west. Captain of saints, he urged legendary oxen from privation into Zion's turmoil, confronting disease, purges, Johnson's army, anti-bigamy laws, Brother Brigham's counsels, battled soft-haired Emma's joining with a married man her father's age, whipped for granddaughters dying one by one, born to that union, gathered all but Emma and her sister Rachel, abandoned 8 years' land and cattle, dreams, and not foreseeing through despair a century when scores of his seed blossom in the rose, valiantly singing old hymns of belief in things he knew. Unflicked by his scourge, he died in Iowa and laid his shattered dust beneath a stone of reasoned sacrifice. I thank Linda for her dark eyes, her observant manner of taking in all things around her, her silence in observation, her well-chosen utterances for those moments when voices must speak.
Thank you, Phyllis, and thank you, John. Recalling Linda Soto is both pleasurable and, of course, has some sadness because we miss her. And when I met Linda, she was a poet and a fiction writer, and a remarkably articulate human being who championed causes. We met in a small group of people that we called Mormons for ERA at John's and Linda's house, and we signed, among other things, signed a petition that appeared in a full-page ad in the Salt Lake Tribune. And as a journalist, you know, I was not really sticking closely to the cardinal rules of journalism to be signing a public petition of that kind, but I thought it was important. And Linda and John were people who taught us why it was important. Those of you who were at Linda's memorial earlier will have heard some of this, and I apologize ahead of time. I'm going to read some of what I read at that time because it summarizes my feelings about Linda as a writer and as a human being. And the poem that Phyllis read of hers, Fact of My Life, was a poem I also admired, and I titled this this paper, this brief remembrance, Fact of Her Life. In June 1977, about 14,000 Utah women occupied the Salt Palace in Salt Lake City for the International Women's Year, IWY, state conference. Once I realized, after the conference was completed, what had gone on there, as editor of Utah Holiday Magazine, I realized we should have covered it, and I started looking for someone who had attended, who was a writer. And I found that Linda had been there and had opinions about it and knowledge of it. I asked her if she might be willing to write an article. Linda, within a week, Linda had organized everything on 3x5 index cards. She proceeded to put together a bold, incisive story that we published that summer. And it disclosed, among other things, how thousands of Mormon women assigned by their Ward Relief Society organizations as conference delegates helped to vote down dozens of propositions supporting equal rights for men and women. Not a happy detail to remember, but all too true. Linda reported that men with walkie-talkies patrolled the aisles instructing their charges how to vote. Her work on this watershed event was more nuanced and more in depth than any coverage of the conference by Salt Lake's newspapers, and that story launched a career for Linda as a journalist. Immediately she became, seemed almost immediately, that she had waded in far enough that she became one of Utah's most skilled and important investigative reporters. She had a passion for thorough and meticulous research, and she knew how to write. At the time I put together this little presentation, I mentioned it to a friend named Amelia Grail, who also wrote for Utah Holiday Magazine. And she immediately remembered how the IWY conference had gone and Linda's reporting of it. This is what she said. I was there too at IWY. And I had stood the week before in a fast and testimony meeting in my ward and told my sisters not to be afraid of equality. There had been some real fear. I wasn't assigned as one of the 10 women chosen from my ward, but that was okay. I was planning on being there anyway. I was so moved that Linda's story could capture the feelings of people like me. When it came out in the magazine, I locked myself in the bathroom with a bottle of cooking wine and read it start to finish. It did for me what I think it must have done for a lot of other Mormon women. Here's another story involving Linda that has always been a favorite of mine. In the 1980s, when her reputation as a feminist and award-winning journalist had reached the attention of thousands of ordinary Utahns, but also had attracted notice of several general authorities in the LDS Church, she heard a knock at her kitchen door one mid-afternoon. On her threshold, when she answered, stood John Carmack, not the well-known software programmer, but the member of the LDS First Council of the 70, as well as Linda's stake president. Had they come for her membership? Or perhaps seeking further light and knowledge about their mother in heaven? No, as it turned out, after Linda had invited them to come in, they asked if she might be willing to tell them anything she had been able to learn about a young document dealer named Mark Hoffman, who had recently been charged with murder. It was then they noticed their fearsome feminist hostess was wearing an apron and that her kitchen was filled with the aroma of fresh baked goods. So at Linda's kitchen table, she served her visitors cookies and milk, and they picked her brain about forgery and murder. Feminism, food, fiction, poetry, a female deity, and good reporting. They were all part of the same mix for Linda Sillitoe, which personifies how naturally she could blend opposites and complexities in her life, as she did in that poem, Fact of My Life. I brought with me this morning an old, old copy of Utah Holiday Magazine. The bottom has been torn off. Can't even see the headline on the page, but it says, The Excommunication of Sonia Johnson. That's Sonia Johnson on your left, and Jeffrey Willis, her bishop, on the right. And did I mix that up? Did I turn that? Yes, I turned that around. I knew I could do it if I tried. Yes. If I had a mirror, I'd know what I was doing. So I thought I'd just read you the first couple of paragraphs of this story. It's only a teaser, but she did... I helped her some with this story. I ended up interviewing her bishop over the telephone, but she did 90% of the story, and it had a big impact, that story. Here's how she started it. Outside the modern brick building in Oakton, Virginia, the night was bitterly cold, but a crowd was already gathering. They had come through the trial of Sonia Johnson over her membership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but the windows of the Oakton Stake Center were dark and the doors were locked. Many in the crowd had been on hand when Sonia Johnson was first, quote, called to court by her bishop in the Sterling Park Ward Chapel on November 17. Mingled here were Johnson's supporters, interested bystanders, and members of the local and national press. But this time there was a new building to find, and the trial was held at night, meaning that many reporters would miss their deadline for Sunday morning editions. And now it appeared they would also camp out in the cold. Well, this is just a bare teaser of a very thorough and fair piece about the events leading up to Sonia Johnson's excommunication. But Linda, of course, did the best job of giving us the detail and the nuance of that story of anybody who covered it locally or nationally, it seems to me. And she went on to do that kind of reporting over a long career. I am very honored to have been associated with Linda Silico in the way that I was, and like the rest of us, I will miss her. Thank you.
I too am honored to be part of this group of speakers. We're all connected in several ways. We all have had experiences writing for Utah Holiday and Sunstone, and it's interesting how interconnected we all are. And of course, I'm delighted to be able to talk about our friend Linda as well. I've been to a lot of memorial services over the last decade or so of people I consider to be the great stars of the Mormon intellectual community, people like Leonard Arrington, Sterling McMurrin, Delmon Oswald, Lo Bennion, Gene England, people like that, and I've thoroughly enjoyed their memorial services. They all contributed so much, especially in the academic world. My sense of loss over Linda is more personal and direct, however, because she was one of us. She was one of my generation, the 60s, 70s generation, the Sunstone Dialogue generation. She was one of us. We tried to create our own world within the world of Mormonism, within the larger world, and tried to connect those worlds together. I think I first heard of Linda during a meeting that Peggy Fletcher and I managed to get with Marion D. Hanks, and we went in to show him Sunstone, some of the new issues of Sunstone and some of the early cartoon books, and he looked through the cartoon books and laughed and really chuckled out loud, and he said, "You know, some of the brethren wouldn't find these very funny." But he couldn't help himself. And then he went through an edition of Sunstone, looked at the masthead, and he read down it, and he knew many of the people. He knew many of us. I had had a Marion D. Hanks scholarship at BYU, and he knew Linda as well. And her name came up, and then shortly thereafter, I became acquainted with Linda through John, through Sunstone. But our major work together was Salamander, and I'd like to tell you some things about our work with that book that I've never shared with anybody, and I doubt that she has either. Salamander, of course, came about because of the October 1985 murders of Kathy Sheets and Steve Christensen, which revealed the remarkable forgery and fraud career of Mark Hoffman. And clearly, Linda didn't need a co-author. I mean, she was a strong, independent voice. I'm not sure she ever co-authored anything again with anybody else. And I'd only had one experience with it, and that was the Utah Holiday article that Fred Esplin and I wrote. I think it was called Bombs and Historical Bombshells, and it was really the first major piece done on the Hoffman story. And it was perhaps naive of us to think that two very strong-willed, highly opinionated people such as ourselves could actually work compatibly together. and constructively, but we didn't even think of that. We just jumped right in, and it worked beautifully well. I think one thing in our favor, we were both high school debaters on the varsity debate team, so we both respected the rules of evidence and logic and persuasive writing. Truth-seeking was paramount for both of us. And we also had a strong motive to do justice to the families of the victims and to the many victims of the fraud and forgeries. And as it turned out, we had very similar worldviews. I received after the murders, we spent a lot of time trading information with each other. We were both getting a lot of information. I was getting some by virtue of being involved with Dialogue, and she because of the Desert News. And so every day we'd call each other several times. Then one day I got a call from Signature Books asking if I would write a book about the story. And I explained that, of course, I'm a full-time architect, and I really don't have time to put my career aside, nor would it probably be a good idea from any number reasons. So it was suggested that I find a co-author. I called some friends, Fred Esplin and some others, and asked if they would co-author. They all turned me down. And I called Linda, and she also turned me down. She was covering the story for the Desert News and really, really couldn't put that career aside either. But shortly thereafter, she called back and said, "Would you reconsider?" She had been taken off the story, and she was very upset about it. She was covering it in a very thorough, honest, straightforward way, which was not really the spin that the news wanted to put on it. They wanted to shape the stories in certain directions, which if you followed their coverage of the Hoffman case and the Tribune's coverage, they were very, very different. The headlines for the same event would sometimes be exactly opposite. So she quit the news and became a co-author. And we had a good contract to Signature Books. It was an 18-month contract, which ended up being 27 months. And the book was published in 1988. It was, for 10 months, the number one best-selling book in the Intermountain States. And it was a Pulitzer Prize nominee. And it's gone through 6 or 7 editions, 3 or 4 versions. It was republished just a couple of years ago again. And even just 2 days ago, I got a call from a TV station asking me to speak about the Salamander book and the Hoffman story. So this is a story that never dies. So we had a lot of mutual respect. We divided the tasks. We divided the interviews. Linda interviewed the Sheets family. I spent a lot of time with the police. I talked to Hoffman's former missionary companions, former schoolmates, historians, the Tanners, Al Ross, the Christensens, and we met twice a week. Once we'd meet at her office on 13th East, or 13th South, and then on Sundays we'd meet at the Sillitoe home. So I'd like to tell you just a couple of quick stories, things that happened during this 3-year period, really, that maybe you haven't heard about. We were on the Larry King Show. That was quite a trip, and so were two authors who wrote the book Mormon Murders, a very slanted book. They had nothing good to say about anybody in Utah, and we found ourselves in the funny position of having sort of to defend the culture and be more balanced about the relationship between church and history and faith and so forth. We wanted to interview President Hinckley, Dallin Oaks, and Hugh Pinnock, because all of them were involved in the Hoffman case in various ways, buying documents for the church, hiding away in the First Presidency's vault, and so forth. They let us know that they don't grant interviews because they can't control the outcome. And so I suggested to Dallin Oaks that we write them some questions, and they could answer them and send them back in writing. So we got together and wrote a page and a half of questions, sent them in, and they honored our request. All three of those general authorities wrote answers to those questions, sent them back, and clearly they didn't look at each other's answers, they didn't correlate them, they just wrote them, and we used them in the book in context as we said we would. Another key breakthrough was finding the source of Hoffman's historical information. we were wondering how he could have found so much historical data such that all the historians were essentially fooled, and from Leonard Arrington on down. And it occurred to me that maybe he had been up at the Mary Library in Western Americana, and that was confirmed by one of his former roommates. So we went up there and found the call slips that Hoffman had signed to check out books, going all the way back to 1976. In fact, Steve Christensen and Mark were sometimes both in the same library at the same time doing research on different subjects. They probably didn't know each other. So we found these Mark Hoffman signatures, and we looked up things he had reviewed and found the sources of many of his historical documents. But more importantly, we also found call slips signed by someone named Mark Hansen, or Mike Hansen. And that Mike Hansen was the name he used to buy the bomb parts. It was a pseudonym, another MH name, and he was hiding his research trail even back 10 years before the bombings. And this information was extremely valuable to the police in putting together the case. Then something else interesting happened. As a result of us sharing that with the police, and we had had no contact with them prior to that, Ken Farnsworth, who died not too long ago, decided to reciprocate, and he gave back information to us. So he would come over to the Sillitoe's house on Sunday and knock on the door, ring the doorbell. He'd come in, he'd put a pile of his research documents from the police on a table. He'd go downstairs and watch football with John while leaving Linda and I to just rifle through all the police stuff. We'd copy everything, and then he'd come up, walk out the door, and leave. And he'd never say a word. When we'd never say a word, it was just an understanding. And because he's deceased now, I guess I can say this. But it helped us a great deal. The sentencing hearing at the prison was quite a sobering experience. Linda and I sat directly behind Bill Hoffman, the father, and he sat behind Mark and Dory, and they sat in front of the three parole board people, and the rest of the room was empty except for guards. So this was a very closed group. And we sat there while Hoffman was asked questions, and he talked about how the murders were just a game to him, that Steve Christensen could have been run over by a car just as easily. And he really had no sense of remorse or guilt or regret or anything. It was very cold, and he must have felt invincible somehow. And it was stunning to us that somebody could be so removed and non-empathetic as he was. So clearly Linda and I had different natures and styles, but I think our partnership worked well. We only had one difficult time, and I don't even remember what it was about. And I don't know if John knows either, but something bothered her enough for her to write me a letter. And her letter shook me. She's a powerful person. And I wrote a letter back, and I think the handwriting was shaky. I don't respond that way to anybody else in the world. And immediately there was understanding, and everything went well after that. We just had that one experience. Another difference is I tend to rely a lot on facts and reason, and Linda does too. She's incredibly intelligent. I speak of her as if she still is with us, and it's hard not to do that. But she also believed in extra-rational things in her dreams and visions. And one day she shared with me that she had had a very realistic dream about Mark Hoffman having killed someone that nobody knew about previously in southern Utah County, somewhere down in the Payson, Salem area. And she shared this with Mike George, one of the police detectives with the city. And he took it seriously enough that they actually investigated it. She could see in her mind a house with an address that was facing a certain bungalow facing west, etc. And they tried to find it. We had had an inkling of this because one of Hoffman's roommates told us that they had hypothetically planned the murder of the owner of Lagoon, David Freed, because they wanted to steal his coin collection. Anyway, so that, I think, became the substance of a subsequent novel. So we, after the book was published, we went on the speaking tour. We spoke at all the universities, and really were sent by signature books to little towns in Idaho and all over the place. Just crazy, really, all of the places we went to promote the book. And after that, we had little contact. Over the last 20 years, we call each other occasionally. The last time I saw Linda was up at Weber State. Somebody had asked for a book to be signed, and I went and had it signed. We talked to each other, caught up on things, let me just say we remain friends, and I'm glad that we did. My sense of her is a strong woman, intimidating to some, serious, even fierce in her visage, all of which belied a very generous spirit and a golden heart. I'll miss our long conversations. They were very analytical sometimes. They'd start off with both of us being soft-spoken, and then a little louder, and we'd get more animated. And as we had more insights and breakthroughs, it could be pretty lively, and it was great. Others of you, have known her longer and more consistently over time. My experience with her is more of a kind of a once-in-a-lifetime supernova, which lasted 3 years. And I'll never forget it. I'll always treasure the experiences we had. The last thing I wrote here: she took so many things with her when she left us, but she gave us so many beautiful things before she left us.
John asked me to tell you that Sunstone is making available copies of Linda's only published collection of poems called Crazy for Living. They're on the table back there. I'm going to read one to you, because my greatest regret in knowing Linda is that she didn't write and publish more poems. This is the one she ends the book with, called Rules for Living. Wake slowly. Enter the shifting particles of air and tent, and dreams that self-sort like traffic. Allow for their adjustment as you merge and gain speed. Gather your relatives. Sun through the windows, water in the plants, kibble to the furred flakes, to fish and frogs, as you drink sky and water. Never drive a dead road. Someone imagined the whorls of freeway and it grew. Children trudging the determined sidewalks bring you a play to improvise under semaphores. All day, play the patterns. Be a chip in the kaleidoscope that reforms moment by moment. You shiver a change, you hold on. You sing best in silence, yet with others, you design a rose. The time is yours, and if you have nothing else to say about Linda, grab one of these books and read a poem. Thank you.
My initial acquaintance with Linda was from afar, just like it was with Sunstone Dialogue, since we were living on the East Coast until 15 years ago, and I never had occasion to come out to Sunstone's or have those face-to-face encounters. But over the years, I really enjoyed reading her poetry, first of all, and eventually some of her articles about Sonya Johnson, and then in the late 80s, the book, The Salamander. So I was an avid fan for all those years. Finally, in about 1990, she was the guest. She was a guest speaker at the Exponent 2 retreat in New Hampshire, where I was at. So that was my first opportunity to meet her. So that was the beginning of a nice friendship. Because in 1995, I moved to Arizona and found that she had moved to Arizona too. And so for about 6 years, we were in Arizona together, enjoyed Linda. We had group of friends, women friends, that got together at least once a month, and Linda was able to join us, and it was just such a wonderful addition to our group there. We really appreciated and enjoyed her. And then just last year, I did a retrospective on Sonia Johnson's excommunication on the 30th anniversary at Sunstone last year, and I knew Linda was the real expert and the most knowledgeable person, so I corresponded with her by email, and despite the terrible health problems she was having, she used her energy to respond to my questions, and I think she had John delve into the archives and get copies for me of all of the old Holiday articles and some of the things she had written for the Mormon Women's Forum, and so I had a pretty comprehensive overview of the Sonia Johnson years, the experiences. And so I really appreciated Linda's willingness to do that, and despite her health problems. And she, I think she really enjoyed outreach, even though she couldn't get out of her house the last year or two very much. But even as recently as about February, March, I enjoyed some nice email correspondence with her. So it was such a great shock to hear her passing in April. But I just wanted to share how much I enjoyed the friendship that I did have with her in these last years.
I loved Linda. She was just such a beautiful woman, and one of my favorite poems that seems apropos was coming back. Nothing here but the howl of a big dog. Purple wildflowers, random in the brush. The long triangles of pine and fir above brown water, gabbling nothing over rocks. On stone in a meadow in the Rockies, I breathe as if for 14 years I vanished without air. I breathe in zeros. The meadow glows, unaware of me. Nothing here needs or cares. All is taken in by living and dying, each blade, each petal turned inward, outward, as if nothing matters. Nothing is what I came for. Nothing can soak my pores as I sit here, sighting mountainous ships on the curved horizon. This is the good part. Thank you, Linda. And see how far we go against what currents, only to reach old shores in unexpected ways.
I have a question for Alan. What was the reaction of the general authorities of the church to your book? Did either of you see any static about that? It seems to me, and I might be wrong about this, but it seems to me that they commissioned somebody else to write a book later about that same thing.
Their response was deafening silence, which nevertheless reverberated intensely. They said nothing. President Hinckley, actually he wasn't president, Benson was president, but he was essentially running the church. They cooperated with us. We promised them that if they gave us answers to our questions, we would print them verbatim in context, and we honored that, and they honored that. Each of them answered about 8 out of the 12 questions. But there were impacts. A middle-level church bureaucrat banned my architectural firm from doing work for the church. And there were some other impacts as well. but they never questioned any of the accuracy or factual nature of the book. We've never had a single person say one word about any of that. But they did then have various people in the church write another book. There were about 5 or 6 books written on the Hoffman story altogether. The most recent one of which is a very thin book by George Throckmorton, who we brought aboard to do an epilogue which detailed how the forgeries were detected to be forgeries, mainly the cracking of the ink, the alligatoring of the ink under a microscope. And he has his own theory. So there are several books, but ours was the first, I think, 560 pages, and it's It was reviewed well in the New York Times Review of Books and really well regarded, and we're pretty proud about that.
Well, this book sounded like something I'm familiar with. Salamander book. I think we sold about 50,000 copies, maybe more, some returns, and thinking of Linda's attachment to the process of writing the book, along with you, Alan, Linda was someone who could start a page, "The lake held the light," but that wasn't, poetry wasn't as far as she went. She had a police daughter's background, and she had a chart on her office, went around from beginning to end, this chronology chart. Who did what, when, how, what we knew, what we didn't know, where the blanks were, question marks. She had a police office in there figuring out what was going on, and you were in there working that too. That was really something to see. A poet with an analytical side. And I'm sure you know more about that.
I'm Janine Justin. I'm Linda's sister. And I'm not known very widely as a writer, but I'm also a writer. And I don't know if I would be without Linda's example and support. And I want to say, Mr. Swenson, family belongs on that list that you said. Linda was very attached to a family and very generous in sharing with the family. She was a peacemaker in our family, and even all the years she was ill and could hardly ever attend anything, she never missed the birthday of one of her nieces and nephews and would send presents, and that's an important part of her to bring up. And I wish I had her courage. And I'm grateful for her love and example.
Doug Tabor. Linda is my sister-in-law. I've known her for more than 40 years. And let me just add to all that was said, that those who know Linda know that she was deeply empathetic. She understood the people she talked to. She felt their joy. She felt their pain. And every bit of that joy and every bit of that pain she carried with her the rest of her life. She was a warrior. She was a hero.
Yes. I didn't really know Linda very well. She was a few years older than I was, but I first met her through her poems. And when I first heard of her death, I think we passed an email when we were staying. I wrote to a friend right away who said, as far as her poetry goes, I mean, she was the real thing. She was a poet. And I just want to read one that was one of the early ones that I read into, and it's called Song of Creation. Who made the world, my child? Father made the rain, silver and forever. Mother's hand drew riverbeds and hollowed seas, drew riverbeds and hollowed seas to bring the rain home. Father bridled winds, my child, to keep the world new. Mother clashed fire free from stones and breathed it strong and dancing, and breathed it strong and dancing the color of her hair. He armed the thunderclouds, rolled out of heaven. Her fingers flickered hummingbirds, weaving the delicate white snow, weaving the delicate white snow, the waterfall of flowers. And if you live long, my child, you'll see snow burst from thundercloud and lightning in the snow. Listen to mother and father laughing. Listen to mother and father laughing behind the locked door.
Thank you.
I hate to do this, but this is time to bring this session to a close. There will be another session here called In Memoriam, remembering Susan Haber, Linda's sister, Beverly Hoppe and Carl Rosenbaum, pardon me, Carl Schnibbe, and I guess it's Reed Hunter. But that means that we need to clear the room in the next 15 minutes. Thank you for coming. Thank you for sharing your memories of Linda. And as I mentioned, pick up one of the books. That's the best memory you might ever have. Thank you. Thanks.